Welcome back to the West London Witch. This episode includes a story of suicide and may not be suitable for everyone. Listener discretion is strongly advised. Bakersfield, California, May 1953. It's a warm summer's evening, and floods of tulle, taffeta, and rented tuxes are flowing into the gymnasium of BHS, Bakersfield High School. It's the annual senior prom, and the air is thick with excitement and Liquinette hairspray. Outside, the silver moon is hanging high in the sky as the Ames brothers softly croon away about you inside the gym. Skirts rustle, heels clack on the polished wooden floor. Sweaty hands intertwine as secret kisses are stolen behind chaperones' backs. And between the nerves, the lust, and the shimmering lights of the hall, there is magic in the air. Couples sway gently back and forth, forgetting about the heat outside or the imperfections they saw in themselves before their dates picked them up. In this moment, all is right. As the song fades to a melodic close, a spotlight illuminates the stage. The microphone crackles as the student body president announces the 1953 prom king and queen. She is a vision of pastel perfection, thick golden hair cascading over her bare shoulders, a bright, wide smile shadowed by her heavy dark lashes. He is the team quarterback, tall, strapping, dark hair carelessly roughed into a James Dean daydream. A striking couple, a pair like no other, the obvious choice for high school royalty. But behind the glittery plastic tiara and the heavy Letterman jacket is a secret, a forbidden love, and a new life on its way. You see, when Susie and Johnny realized she was pregnant, they desperately tried to keep it from their parents. But sadly, it wasn't long before an ill-fated phone call on the party line led to Susie's mother getting a call from the nosy neighbor. Susie's parents decided she would finish the last month of high school, then disappear to have the child in secret. The baby would be given away, and Susie would never speak of her fall from grace ever again. Johnny's parents forbade him from ever having anything to do with his flaxen floozy. He was to be sent to basic training the week after graduation, and the two were never to meet again. The teens were devastated. They were each other's world, their future, their reason for living. The pair couldn't imagine a life without each other or their baby. But they did know a way they could spend eternity together, preserved in their pubescent perfection. The couple spent prom night twisting, jiving, swinging, and strolling. Susie laid her head on Johnny's chest as the two rocked back and forth to the liquid vocals of the spaniel singing, "Baby, It's You." His heartbeat in steady time with the soulful piano, as her heart held the high melody. How she wished she could live in this moment forever. And as he laid a soft kiss atop her head, she knew he felt the same. As the night came to a close, kids clambered into their borrowed Chryslers, Lincolns, and Packard convertibles, compliments of their parents, of course, as they raced to 19th Street to catch the last sodas and ice creams before Woolworth's shuttered its doors for the night. But not Susie and Johnny. They decided to take a walk around campus. Just the two of them, hand in hand, crowns on their heads, and heaviness in their hearts. Together, the couple climbed hundreds of bleacher steps until they were at the top of the stadium seating. As Johnny looked out over the football field, he remembered the rush of team huddles under the blinding lights, Susie's cheers from the stands, and his parents' palatable pride as they watched their son complete perfect passes and avoid vicious attacks in the pocket. He subconsciously touched the felt B over his heart. His Letterman jacket heavy and hot in the summer heat. Together, Susie and Johnny climbed over the safety rail, Susie's heels slipping on the bottom rung. But Johnny held her steady, and the two came together for the deepest, longest, most fervent kiss the world had ever known. No sooner had their lips parted, so did their hands from the rail. In a blur of BHS blue and silky pink petticoats, the lovers plummeted to the grass below. They were found the next morning, sprawled across the dewy lawn, hands held tight, Susie's free hand over her belly, her crown matted in the thick blonde locks. Johnny's head careened towards Susie, his lifeless eyes fixed upon her. A modern-day Romeo and Juliet. Susie and Johnny may have died that night, but if you go to BHS football field on prom night, you might just see two teens climb the stadium steps, kiss at the top, and soar off the back of the bleachers. But you won't see them hit the ground. The two disperse into a mist and simply dissolve into the summer air, becoming the night. Now, I know this story is true because I'm from Bakersfield. I grew up on this story. And my best friend's aunt's husband's older brother was a graduate of the class of 1953. Hello, and welcome to the season two finale of The West London Witch, a podcast where we share stories about those moments where we find ourselves very much not alone. When I was a little girl, I got in trouble at a slumber party once for telling a scary story. Everyone told a story. It just turned out that mine was a little more extra, shall we say. It ended with two of the sleepover girls in tears. I was very proud of myself. As a lover of Goosebumps and Are You Afraid of the Dark, I was thrilled with my budding ability to share a scary story. My friend's mom, however, was not as impressed, and I was never invited to another sleepover at little Allison's house ever again. Turns out elementary slumber parties were not my scene. So I am very thankful for all of you listeners who voluntarily tune in to hear our stories. In the great tradition of Are You Afraid of the Dark, we have collected an assortment of scary stories to share with you today. Welcome to the West London Witches version of the Midnight Society. I hope you're all seated comfortably, safe in your homes. Turn off the lights. Go on. I dare you. Submitted for the approval of the Midnight Society, I'm Rebecca Strazina, and this is the West London Witch Season 2 finale. I know it's true. A friend of a friend told me so. Part 2. Our first submission to the Midnight Society comes from our friend Jimmy Horrors of the Night's End podcast. Jimmy takes us to the rugged and wild wilderness of the Australian outback. We all know of the endless dangerous creatures that roam the Australian bush, but you may not have this creature on your list of species that kill.
Before I begin, I'd like to acknowledge the Boonwurrung people, traditional custodians of the land on which I've recorded this, and pay my respects to their elders past, present, and emerging. I extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. Picture yourself on a much-needed vacation in Australia. You decide you want to see more than just the cities and hire a van to drive out into the country. You see and experience all the things that are a signature to Australia. The blistering heat. The vast expanses of desert. The dense bush that bears the smell of gum nuts and wattle. You hear the laughing call of a kookaburra, the erratic squawks of the galahs, and see the bounding kangaroos. You decide to camp out in the bush to experience the real outback. You set up camp and have a cup of tea from the billy that bubbles over the campfire. The sun is low in the sky and will be completely swallowed up by the horizon before long. You decide you want to take a dip in the billabong before then. So you walk down to the water and in the low light you dive in, reveling in the fresh water, feeling the serenity you have wanted for so long. But in a brief moment, the water is disturbed by something other than you. Feeling an unwanted presence but not able to see it, you get out of the water. After drying yourself, you turn around. Before you is a hulking creature. You have interrupted its habitat, and for this, you will be eaten. Can you guess what it could be? Well, a bunyip, of course. Australia, the land down under, is home of a vast number of creatures. Those that we see on a regular basis are usually not deadly, but Australia is certainly known for having a large number of deadly creatures in its offering. From the sea we have box jellyfish, bull, tiger and great white sharks, stonefish, blue-ringed octopuses. From the land we have the largest collection of the world's deadliest snakes, tiger snake, brown snake, inland taipan, red, yellow and blue-bellied snakes, just to name a few. We also have many different deadly spiders such as the red back, white tip and funnel web. And don't even get me started on the crocodiles. So, I think it's safe to say there are a lot of creatures to be wary of when traversing our vast and beautiful land. One such deadly creature that has been completely shrouded in mystery for hundreds of years is that of the bunyip. It is a creature that has origins in indigenous Dreamtime stories, and in history was said to have caused much fear throughout the tribes of Aboriginal peoples, as well as the white population throughout the country, particularly in the state of Victoria, where I live. Bunyips are aquatic mammals, and it is said they are solo creatures, preferring to be alone in a dwelling that they are highly territorial over. They reside in billabongs, rivers, creeks, and swamps. If you go into their domain, they are likely to sneak up on the trespasser and eat them. There are many eyewitness accounts of the bunyip, with the most recurrent sightings happening between the 1840s and 1850s. The description given from the earliest sightings is that they have sharp claws, many eyes, and can move at a fast speed. Other descriptions of them are that they look like a giant starfish, whereas others claim that it has a crocodile head and a dog-like face, flippers, and walrus-like tusks. Here is one of the earliest descriptions printed in the Geelong Advertiser in 1845. The bunyip, then, is represented as uniting the characteristics of a bird and of an alligator. It has a head resembling an emu, with a long bill, at the extremity of which is a transverse projection on each side, with serrated edges like the bone of the stingray. Its body and legs partake of the nature of the alligator. The hind legs are remarkably thick and strong, and the forelegs are much longer, but still of great strength. The extremities are furnished with long claws, but the indigenous people say its usual method of killing its prey is by hugging it to death. When in the water, it swims like a frog, and when on shore, it walks on its hind legs with its head erect, in which position it measures 12 or 13 feet in height. I don't know about you, but being hugged to death seems like an interesting way to go. Several unidentified fossils have been found over the years and have been attributed to the bunyip. At one point, in 1846, a skull was found near Balranald in the Murrumbidgee River. It went as far as being placed in the Australian Museum in Sydney, though it was discovered later to be a disfigured skull of a calf. Other than sounding utterly terrifying to look at, there are some interesting legends about its origins. One such legend claims that it was in fact a man named Bunyip who ate his totem animal, breaking the Rainbow Serpent's greatest law. As such, he was banished and transformed into an evil spirit that would dwell in the water and lure animals and tribesmen so that he could eat them. Some indigenous believe that the Bunyip is a bloodthirsty murderer, while others believe that it is a being sent to Earth to punish and bring justice to those that commit evil acts. So even though there is much conjecture over what the Bunyip in fact looks like, and even where it came from, if you ever fancy taking a trip into the Australian outback, be wary near isolated bodies of water. Otherwise, you may be the next addition to the missing persons list in Australia.
Our next submission to the Midnight Society is in keeping with our theme of hometown horrors. You may recognize this next storyteller from episode 31, Haunting 9-5. Becky Kalimnik of the Homespun Haints podcast is submitting her story of the Phantom Monk.
As a child, I obsessed over local ghost stories and ghostly legends from my home in East Tennessee. The endless tree-covered Appalachian Mountains where I grew up are only sparsely populated by living humans, but they are crawling with ghosts and lore. One of my favorite stories as a child takes place in the small town of Charleston, Tennessee. Charleston is home to about 700 people, give or take. It sits on the Hiawassee River, and it's about midway between Knoxville and Chattanooga, if you're familiar at all with Tennessee geography. While passenger trains no longer pass through this part of Tennessee, once upon a time, Little Charleston sat upon the rail route between Baltimore and New Orleans. In 1867, that very train traveled toward Charleston, Tennessee, during a brutal thunderstorm. The Hiawassee flooded, and waters rose so high that portions of the tracks submerged into the damp soil. The train, no longer having any tracks to control it, plunged into a ravine next to the river. Charleston had no hospital, but it did have a doctor. Hearing the screams from the wreckage, the population of Charleston rushed to the scene to pull the dead and injured from the overturned cars. The doctor worked tirelessly to help the injured, and the townspeople counted the bodies of the dead, making sure everyone was accounted for. And every body was accounted for, except one. About a week after the wreck, a brother and sister came to Charleston looking for their brother who had been on the train. The missing brother happened to be a Franciscan monk, and several people who survived the wreck remembered seeing him on the train. However, brother and sister checked the casualty list and did not see the monk's name upon it. They eventually gave up and returned home, as it seemed their brother had just disappeared into thin air. They were not able to speak to the doctor because he had gone on a sabbatical to recuperate from the grueling task of saving hundreds of lives. Months later, the doctor returned. And after his return, people who visited the doctor noticed that he had a new possession. At that time, it was quite the status symbol to have your own skeleton in your office, and it seemed the doctor had finally saved up enough money to get one. Lore says he was quite proud of his new acquisition and showed it off to the entire town. Life continued normally until the old doctor retired and sold his practice and the building to a new doctor. As the new Dr. McClary moved in his offices, the townspeople were quick to tell him the stories of the old doctor and how the office was haunted. Dr. McClary shrugged the stories off at first. McClary hadn't been in his new practice long before he started seeing a figure walking through the waiting room long after he had closed for the evening. Running into the room, he saw that no one was there. Another time, he caught a glimpse of what looked like a person wearing a brown hooded cloak in the glass of his medicine cabinet. Again, no one was there. These instances continued for years. But as many people who live and work in haunted places know, over time, one just grows used to the ghosts. So as the sightings of the brown cloaked figure continued, Dr. McCleary learned to ignore it. He also learned to ignore the omnipresent clicking sound he heard throughout the office. He said it sounded like someone clicking two marbles together. Time passed, and Dr. McCleary retired. And in 1932, crews came to demolish the building he worked in. As they tore down the walls, one of the workers found something unusual walled up behind the plaster in one of the closets. A monk's habit and rosary. You can probably infer what happened to the poor monk on that fateful day in 1867. According to the stories I have heard from locals and from Miranda Young, a paranormal investigator from the area, the monk did perish in that crash. The doctor, thinking the man would not have a family that would notice him gone, set about stripping the monk's flesh and muscle from his bones. He carried out this act in a cast iron, claw-footed bathtub that still exists. One wall of the original building that the doctor worked in still stands as well. To this day, locals still see the monk wandering the tracks near the crash. He wears his distinctive brown Franciscan habit with hood, and sometimes you can hear that strange clicking sound from the beads of his rosary. I myself have never seen the monk, but I do know people who have. He's a kind, benevolent presence. And if you do happen to see him out of the corner of your eye as you wander through Charleston, Tennessee, know that he's looking out for you, protecting you, and still wandering.
I bet you want to know what story got me kicked out of Little Allison's slumber party. Well, here it is. The Andersons were a very normal family who lived in a very normal house in a very normal neighborhood. There was Mr. and Mrs. Anderson, their 16-year-old daughter Nancy, and two 12-year-old twin boys, Jason and Michael. Since the children were a little bit older, Mr. and Mrs. Anderson let them walk home alone after school together. After sports practice and drama rehearsals were finished, there was really only an hour the children were home alone. Just enough time to get some homework done or secretly chat on the phone with your friends. One crisp autumnal afternoon, the trio traipsed through a sea of crunchy golden aspen leaves as they made their way back to their suburban home. Michael and Jason would dash upstairs immediately to hop onto the N64. The processed, upbeat tunes of Mario Kart streaming through the playroom speakers, followed by an endless soft clicking noise as their thumbs danced over the controller's buttons. They might descend into a heated argument over screen watching or who gets to be Mario, but there was a good chance that Nancy would get a solid hour to herself. She would escape to her room, glue herself to her see-through phone, and gossip for an hour with her bestie over the latest high school drama, play games of MASH, or debate if Jonathan Taylor Thomas or James Vanderbeek had better hair. It was her time. This autumnal day felt different. When the siblings reached their front door, it was already ajar. Nancy blamed Jason, who in turn blamed Michael, who couldn't actually remember one way or the other. The house was quiet. Nothing was out of place, and although they debated calling their parents or the police, there wasn't really anything to report. The boys raced upstairs, and the ever-familiar "Welcome to Mario Kart" drifted down the stairs. Nancy went to make a sandwich. Yet, when she did, she noticed a few knives were missing. They must have been in the dishwasher. She took her sandwich upstairs, plopped onto her day-glow orange blow-up chair, terribly uncomfortable but totally the bomb, and proceeded to call her BFF. Whilst on the phone, her friend asked if she could borrow Nancy's half-moon necklace for the homecoming dance. Nancy sat down at her vanity and began to comb through her jewelry box. When all of a sudden, a strange reflection in the mirror caught her eye. In the mirror, Nancy could see movement inside her closet. The closer she looked, the more she could make out the eyes, then the full face, a hand gripped tightly around a long silver kitchen knife, and blood spattered all over the frozen, menacing grin of a man. Nancy was still. She couldn't move, scream, run, or shout to her friend on the phone. Instead, she calmly told her friend that she thinks the necklace is in the bathroom. She'll have to go and check. Nancy set down the phone, calmly left her room, and quickly darted down the hall to the playroom. She was expecting to find the boys glued to the Nintendo, but as she reached the door, it was silent. As she opened the playroom door, she was hit with the overwhelming scent of copper. The room was covered in blood spatter, her brothers a mangled, deformed mess on the floor, butchered beyond all recognition. Nancy wanted to throw up, black out, scream, and pass out all at the same time. But she was in fight or flight mode, and before she could even realize what her body was doing, she was sailing down the stairs. Her eyes were stinging, her throat was thick, and her ears were heavy and blocked. She couldn't remember alerting the neighbors or even the police arriving. But she did remember sitting on the sidewalk, watching as a team of officers led the man from her closet out of her house. He stared at her and then began to shout, "Why didn't you scream? You needed to scream. You were supposed to scream." His words haunted her. They didn't make any sense. But really, at the end of the day, it didn't matter. Her brothers were gone. And although no one said it was her fault, they did ask her why she didn't check on them. How did she not hear them? How could she make a sandwich while her brothers were being slaughtered above her? How did she not realize anything was wrong? At the trial, the man confessed to have watching the children for months. He knew that they went home alone. He knew the boys went directly to the playroom. And he knew that Nancy, the real object of his attention, was a normal teenage girl. He had ran through the plans in his head a million times and loved fantasizing about Nancy's scream, the sound of pure terror pouring out of her. But she didn't scream. She didn't make a sound. It wasn't going right. It wasn't going to plan. Why didn't she scream? Although Nancy didn't scream that day, she would scream every day after, forevermore tormented by the man hidden in her closet. That concludes tonight's submissions for the Midnight Society and Season 2 of The West London Witch. Thank you so much for joining us on this season. This is a podcast that lives and breathes off of the generosity of our storytellers. Thank you to everyone who has shared a story with us. If you have a spooky story you would like featured on Season 3, please reach out to me. You can drop us an email at thewestlondonwitch@gmail.com or find us on Instagram and Facebook at thewestlondonwitch. If you're looking for a way to support the show between now and when season 3 drops in the fall, tell a friend about the show, leave us a review, or follow us on social media. These are all free ways you can help the podcast grow. From all of us here at the West London Witch, thank you so much for your continued support and listenership this season. We cannot wait to bring you the next chapter in the West London Witch Anthology. Until next season, merry meet, merry part, and merry meet again. The West London Witch is created by me, Rebecca Strazina. Our sound designer and production magician is the incredible Danny Cross. Our theme music was bespokely written and performed by the wickedly talented Kyle Hall. Our cover art is the beautiful collaboration between Lizzie Wilson and Jake Bowser. Special thanks to Ms. Sinead Bowers, our quality control and biggest cheerleader. And thank you to you, all of our listeners all over the world. These are your stories. Thank you for sharing them.